Please welcome Dr. Gene Whitney.
Thank you, Jim. Get myself situated here. I changed the title a little bit. Hope you don't mind. I like Sioux Falls. In fact, I like it so much I come back here regularly. I was here 26 years ago. In 1979 for PCORA 5 or 4 or whatever it was then. And I intend to come back 26 years from now to the next 2031 PCORA conference. Yeah, we were coming in on the plane yesterday. It was funny because we were surrounded by people in camouflage gear and orange hats. And, you know, I honestly wondered if these people were coming to PCORA and whether the flavor of PCORA had really changed that much in 26 years. But I need some light. I can't see the screen here, too, or the buttons to push. Is there any? Can we have a little light up? There, that's good. Thanks. It's either on or off. I must say I'm humbled to come to Sioux Falls to talk about Landsat, and most of my talk is going to be about Landsat. I'm going to try to concentrate on the elements of the instrument itself that are of interest to policymakers. I'm going to go over a little bit of the history of Landsat. So this is all old stuff for you. I realize that. It may be tedious, but we're at a point in policymaking now where it's essential for all the people who make decisions in D.C. to understand a little bit of the history of Landsat. And so I'm going to go over some of that and try to emphasize the things that I have to educate some of my colleagues about. I have to deal with bean counters in OMB. And frankly, when you talk about land remote sensing, some of the questions they ask are very interesting. They say, you know, haven't we already photographed the Earth's surface? Do we need to do that again? Questions like that. And so you know that there's a lot of, there's a lack of understanding, and I have to continually educate the policy people around me. So I had to get educated myself, of course, and I knew a little bit about Landsat, but with the help of a whole bunch of people, some of whom are listed on this slide. And these are the people whose visuals I've stolen for this talk as well, although you shouldn't blame them for any failures. I've learned a lot about Landsat and spectral remote sensing over the last couple of years as we've wrestled with what to do with Landsat in this next round. It's been a 33-year battle, and the battle continues, and I'll talk about some of that. I'm going to talk about three things. First, I'm going to say a couple of words about OSTP. It's not a gasoline additive. And some of you are intimately familiar with how the White House is structured and who does what, but some of you may not be. So I'll talk a little bit about OSTP and where that puts me with respect to other administration policymakers. And then I'm going to give a little brief background on Landsat, which will, I'm sure, bore many of you, but again, you have to look at it from my side because it's all fresh to me, okay? And then I'm going to talk about the future of Earth observations because there's some things going on that you either may not be aware of or you may be aware of but don't fully understand the importance or impact of. And I'm going to try to communicate that to you today. Just a word about OSTP. The White House is organized into a series or a set of councils and offices. You all know about the Office of Management and Budget. That's the White House Budget Office, basically. And they have about 600 of the 1,500 White House employees, which tells you how important money is. Some other offices you may be familiar with are the National Security Council, Domestic Policy Council, Council on Environmental Quality, and there's a number of others. Well, one of the offices in the White House is the Office of Science and Technology Policy. OSTP is directed by the President's science advisor, who is currently John Marburger, and that's where I work. And the role of OSTP is twofold. One is a reactive mode. That is, it's our job in OSTP to make sure that we scan the science and technology landscape and make sure that the administration doesn't get blindsided by a technical issue. Sometimes it happens anyway, but we basically advise the president on science and technology issues, and I mean all science and technology issues, everything from allocating the FCC spectrum to stem cell research to remote sensing. I mean, we cover everything possible, imaginable. And my portfolio at OSTP, for example, covers all the earth sciences, including things with leaves and bones and stuff, which I'm not very familiar with, but I still have to cover it. The reactive part of OSTP is to make sure that the president's fully informed about the technical issues that are going on in the world. The other role is more proactive, and that's to implement science direction and policy in the federal government. And that's done through a virtual organization called the National Science and Technology Council. Basically, someone from OSTP works with a group of people from agencies to attack a particular topic. It may be some toxic subject, it could be homeland security, it could be water, could be disasters. But the point is, you bring people from all the federal agencies into a room around a table and you decide, what does the nation need? What kind of science support, research, development, and deployment does the United States need to solve problems in this area? And we write directions basically to the agencies, which OMB buys into, by the way. That's why we do it. If it's not reflected in the budget, then we haven't really done anything, have we? So that's what NSTC is. We have about 30 of these subcommittees, so there's a lot of activity. Some of you serve on NSTC subcommittees. So from OSTP, basically, we worry about what the national needs are. We worry about what the national issues are, and then it's our job to make sure that something happens. And if there's not sufficient leadership within an agency or in a consortium of agencies to make things happen, then it's our responsibility to find that leadership and drive them forward. So that's why it's important that we get involved in Landsat, for example. Let's talk about Landsat a little bit. The perennial question with Landsat is, where are we going? For the 33-year history of Landsat, it's always been, are we going to get the next one launched? How are we going to fund the next system and get it up in the air? This has been a lot of work for a lot of people, and we'd like to do better than that, but that's the way it's been done in the past, and I'll talk about how that might change in the future. So I'm going to give a little bit of an overview of what's happening now. Most of you are aware of that anyway. I'll talk about the data continuity strategy. What if there is a data gap? What are we going to try to do about it? And then I'm going to talk about the decision that was released a year ago about putting Landsat on NPOs and where that might be headed. So what's so great about Landsat? And whenever I get together with OMB, I have to do this litany over and over and over again. You know, it's the global coverage, synoptic global coverage, 16-day repeat cycle. We've got 30-plus years of global coverage to look back on, and all the rest of this. You know this far better than I do. I'm not going to dwell on it, but I just wanted to point out that whenever I get into a discussion with policy people, you know, we have to repeat this over and over and over again because they don't automatically know it. So what's happening now? Well, we've got two Landsats up there, as you all know. Landsat 5 is 18 years past its three-year design life. Not bad. But Landsat 5 doesn't have an onboard data recorder, so we get full U.S. coverage and some global coverage, but we don't get complete global coverage from Landsat 5. Landsat 7 is actually only 5 years past its design life, and it's crippled right now. And the scan line corrector problem, which all of you probably are much more familiar with than I am, produced these stripes, these Venetian blind stripes on the images. And then Jay Fuquay has to sit at his computer and fill in those stripes pixel by pixel to make it look like they aren't there. Isn't that right, Jay? Yeah. I think they've developed some slightly more efficient techniques than that. But USGS now has developed algorithms for filling in those stripes with other data, and the images are quite good and useful for many purposes. But as you also know, the scanline corrector failure created an immediate data gap for some Landsat users, in particular the Foreign Agricultural Service, who tries to do assessments of foreign crops. They immediately lost usefulness in Landsat, and they were a big customer. So that's bad. Another thing that happened with Landsat 7 is one of the three gyros failed. Now, it can operate with two gyros. Now, Jay, you're going to correct me if I say something wrong here, okay? It can operate with two gyros, but I don't think it can operate with one. So one down, two to go. If another gyro fails, we lose Landsat 7. And that could happen any time. And here's the risk curve to prove it. If the mode of failure of Landsat 7 is a gyro failure, then the probability of failure at the end of 2005 is about 40%. In other words, you have about a 40% probability that Landsat 7 is going to last till the end of 2005. And it looks like we may make that. But if you run out to the end of the fuel cycle in 2010, you're down to about 2%. So there's a very high probability that there will be another gyro failure before Landsat 7 runs out of fuel. And that will produce a real data gap. And in any event, the fuel will run out for Landsat 5 in 2009 and Landsat 7 in 2010. So here's where we are in history. We're at 2005 right here. Landsat 7 is going to run out of fuel in 2010. And Landsat 5 is going to run out of fuel in 2009, and either one of them could fail before that. Now, in the meantime, we have a bunch of policy guys down here trying to figure out what to do next. And the clock's ticking, right? We know the clock's ticking, and yet we're struggling with how to solve this problem. So we have two questions. Do we launch another Landsat? Now, you may think that's a terrible question to ask, but you have to realize, I'm going to be bluntly honest with you, in the DC policy world, this is the first question that's asked. You know, do we need another Landsat? Because there are a lot of sacred cows going by the wayside these days for lack of money. And so this question is not as automatic as you might think. Now, of course, everyone in this room thinks we need another Landsat, but there are a lot of other very expensive systems out there that are competing very well, and it's a very competitive budget environment. And so this question is asked, and the answer could be no. The answer could be no. And when you think about the 33-year data history of Landsat, it breaks your heart to think that they would end the Landsat cycle abruptly, but it could happen, and I just want to make you aware that that's a possibility. Now that's the bad news. The good news is we're working hard to make sure that that doesn't happen, and I will fill you in with some of the details on that. The second question is, if there is a data gap, if Landsat 5 and/or 7 fail before we get another instrument launched, what other kinds of data could we use to bridge that gap? And I'd like to talk about that question first. There is a data gap study team, and Jay Fuquay and Ed Grigsby and some others are leading that effort. The question they're asking is, looking at all the other remote sensing, spectral remote sensing imaging assets out there in the world, is there a way to keep up this archive without Landsat? In other words, could we buy or steal data from other instruments that would help fill the gap? And they have a process that they're going through. They're looking at a number of instruments, both domestic and foreign. But the conclusion, basically, is that there is no other instrument like Landsat. There is no other instrument in the world that gives 16-day global coverage. And so you can do partial gap fill, but realistically, both for technical reasons and financial reasons, you'll never be able to replace Landsat data using other existing platforms. And this is a message that we use like a hammer in the policy arena, showing that no matter, everyone thinks, well, just use spot data, or just use the Indian satellite, or just use the CBERS. But we can now demonstrate that none of that is going to work to fully replace the capacity that Landsat provides. No other imaging instrument in the world provides global coverage of 30-meter multispectral data on a 16-day repeat cycle. And the important thing about that synoptic global coverage is, well, here I am preaching to the choir again. One of the examples I use when I explain this to people is glacier retreat. You know, if you suddenly discover that there's a glacier retreating, and you want to know whether that glacier's been retreating for a long time and no one has ever thought to look at it before, you can actually use Landsat data and go back 33 years and see if it's been retreating for 33 years. That's a trivial example, but it's the kind of thing that people understand and demonstrates the value of having that archive. Okay, so we know Landsat can't be replaced. I mean, we know it's not duplicated by any other instrument. So let's see if we can launch another one. How do we do that? Well, a year ago, the White House convened an interagency working group. It was led by Gil Clinger from the National Security Council. He was the policy guy at NSC. And it was convened under the co-direction of NSC, OMB, and OSTP. And this was after the commercialization process had been completed, and there was a non-selection. You know that story as well. The government was going to end up with all the risk in that deal anyway, so it really wasn't commercialization. In retrospect, you know, maybe we should have. I don't know. It's easy to second-guess decisions, but the decision was made not to select that path, and so we lost a couple of years. The clock's ticking. We lost a couple of years in that decision process. So a year ago, we convened this group, and the members consisted of NASA, NOAA, USGS, NGA, and NRO. And this group of guys, under Doug McQuestion's leadership, guys and gals, I should say, did an exhaustive study of all the national capabilities to see if there were some flight of opportunity that we could piggyback on, some way to leverage another platform to make to reduce the pain of launching a Landsat instrument. And at the end of that process, which took several months, there was a decision made, and it was to put Landsat, the operational land imager, the OLI, on NPOS. Now, you all know about NPOS. NPOS is this platform that's co-sponsored by NOAA and the Air Force. It's a National Polar Orbiting Environmental Satellite System. Is that what that is? NPOS? Something like that. It's about the size of a Dodge van. And it had excess power. It had excess space. It had a similar orbit to Landsat, and it just looked like a really good match for the Landsat platform. At that time, they didn't have the details of the INPO's design, but a preliminary examination made it look like it was a very good match. And the beauty of this solution was that we got two for one. Because we didn't have to pay for a launch vehicle, because we didn't have to pay for a lot of the operational stuff, we could actually get two instruments, two land observation instruments, that would take us out to 2020 or beyond. That looked like a good solution. Besides which, NPOs at that time, a year ago, had a lot of political inertia. There were a lot of people who wanted to see NPOs work. There were not a lot of people who wanted to see Landsat work. And so this was a way to piggyback not only technically but politically on an existing platform. So we made the decision to go ahead and put Landsat on NPOs. There was a memo issued by Dr. Marburger from OSTP. And one of the key things about that memo, which a lot of people skip over because you tend to concentrate on the technical aspects, but that memo recognized Landsat as a national asset. Now, that's very important. And if you missed that in the memo, you should go back and look at it, because I had two goals in that process. One was to get Landsat recognized as a national asset. That, what that means is that Landsat becomes an instrument that transcends agencies. It's like a linear accelerator. You know, it's too big for one group to build, so we're going to consider it a national asset, and we're going to invest in it as a nation rather than taking it out of somebody's agency budget. That's a very important piece. The second piece was we were going to make Landsat operational. Landsat's never been operational. And by operational, what I mean is it's up there collecting data, and if it fails, we launch another one. That's what operational means. Previously, Landsat was an experimental imager. We launch one, it collects data, and then later we start trying to figure out how to get the next one up there. That's not operational. And so to convert Landsat to an operational mode where if NPOs failed, there would be another one launched, that was going to be good news. Always this bottom bullet, this strategy will be justified through the normal budget process. That's a sinister little bullet. Because what that means is that no decision is ever final. It has to be negotiated continually through the budget process. And if there's budget troubles in the end, decisions can be changed. And believe me, that's going to cause us all heartburn. Oh, but then there were problems. In the spring, we started to get information back about the design details for NPOs. And NPOs was going to be a lower resolution, for the most part, a lower resolution suite of instruments. And they had moving parts, and the machine, the platform, jittered. To fix the jitter, there had to be a damping structure attached to the OLI. So now, instead of just mounting the OLI on NPOs, you had to put it on some sort of a damping platform. This made it more mechanically complex and more expensive. There were also problems with heat dissipation. I can't remember the list. There, as the NPOs design got firmed up, there was a list of problems. And the OLI, which started out as this little compact, beautiful instrument, started growing as new things had to be attached to accommodate heat dissipation and jitter and other things. And the bottom line was, by the time we knew what NPOs was actually going to look like, in order to accommodate the OLI on NPOs, it was going to cost about another, $180 million. Now, that may not seem like a lot of money to you, but it makes OMB sweat. And so a lot of the impetus, shall we say, for putting the OLI on NPOs was diminished, was decreased. the cost and schedule complications for NPOS itself started to unravel. And if you follow, I'm not an expert on NPOS, but last thing I heard was NPOS cost overrun was projected at, what, $700 million or something like that, and they were going to have to delay launch by a year or two. NPOS started looking like a lot less attractive as a platform. And about that time, when those big numbers started coming up, the Hill wanted to take another look at NPOS, say, how can we solve this problem? So it was just looking really bad. So what should we do? Well, we reconvened our working group, and the working group had done a lot of excellent work the previous year. So we knew a lot of what we needed to know already. So this was something of an abbreviated process. But the group reconvened. The USGS, NASA, NOAA guys went out and did an update. It took about 3 months to look at alternatives. And they came back with a recommendation. Now, this is the punchline you've probably been waiting for, but I want to give you several caveats and disclaimers. Okay, the team came back and recommended a free flyer. So does that mean we're going to have Landsat now as a free flyer? Is this going to be the elusive gap filler that we've always been asking for? Well, we're not there yet. This decision has not been made. It's not final. It has not been vetted by OMB. It certainly hasn't been looked at by Congress. This is only a recommendation within the White House process. So that decision is pending, and I don't want anyone to run out of this room and say that we're going to launch a free flyer, because the decision has not been made yet. But the fact of the matter is, and I'm just trying to be bluntly honest with you, we're running out of options. The downside of launching a free flyer is you get another one-off. You don't get two instruments this time. If you do a free flyer, you only get one. And so we're back in the same mode we were in before, of starting that process, even if we get this one launched, of trying to figure out how we're going to get the next one launched, what the future of Landsat is going to look like. So that's where we are now. It's sort of in suspension, and it's not in suspension, it's in process. OMB is looking at this recommendation very carefully, and we hope to have a decision back from OMB within the next few weeks. We'll see. One of the problems now is that the branch chief at OMB, David Radzinowski, who's the chief of the space and science branch at OMB, just left to take another job, and he was one of our big advocates, so we'll see how that affects the process. During this process, there were some other questions that came up that are really troubling to policymakers, and I just wanted to throw these out and then discuss some possible solutions. First of all, who owns Landsat? Frankly, nobody does. I mean, if you look at MODIS or some of the weather satellites and ask who owns these satellites, NOAA owns them. You know NOAA owns the satellites. If you look at experimental satellites that NASA's putting up, NASA's clearly the owner. Who owns Landsat? Landsat's designed and launched by NASA, but the data is collected and distributed by USGS. So who's in charge? This is a troubling problem because most space systems, as expensive as they are, and a Landsat is going to cost somewhere between $300 and $500 million to launch. Those things don't just happen. You need a strong advocate to drive those systems through the process. And to be quite honest, I don't think NASA views that as their mission, because Landsat to them is an operational system, and USGS is not a space agency, so it's having trouble, especially within the context of the Interior Department, which really doesn't consider itself a space agency, to provide the kind of leadership that Landsat really needs to make it viable. And can Landsat be continued without that strong advocacy? It's an open question, but what I would prefer to do is to find a mechanism to produce that advocacy. I think it can be done. One of the things we did during this process was, well, we did two things. We held a round table at the White House. We invited all the federal agencies who use Landsat to come in and give us a little dog and pony show. And it was very impressive. They all made presentations and it was very convincing. And Dr. Marburger went away convinced that Landsat was a critical tool for land observations. Then we sent out a little questionnaire, which some of you may have received and filled out. And asked for input from the user community. And those things were very interesting. But what it pointed out to us was that the Landsat user community is very broad and very thin. In other words, the users of Landsat are spread out through agencies and universities all around the world. But there's no home for it. There's no agency for it. There's no advocate for it. And that's going to be a problem. So who leads land remote sensing? It could be any of these agencies. Some are more well-suited than others. Let me bring in another subject. And you may think this is a complete non sequitur, a change in topic, but I'm going to show you at the end how it's related. How many people in this room have heard of GEOS? Okay, almost everyone's heard of GEOS, that's good. Global Earth Observation System of Systems. The GEOS system, or the GEOS process, began on July 31st, 2003 with an Earth Observation Summit in Washington. And this was the brainchild of Connie Lautenbacher and John Marburger and some other people in D.C. who were concerned that the U.S. was spending, depending on what you include, U.S. is spending somewhere between $6 and $10 billion a year on Earth observations. That's everything from the satellite systems to stream gauging to seismic networks and so on. And yet a lot of this observational data was completely disconnected to everything else. It was scattered across the landscape in a shotgun fashion. And the idea of this summit was to philosophically start the process of collecting data types to address specific issues. Now, we all know, right, that we should make our data compatible. We have eGov and we have all these things. This is more focused on societal benefit issues. The idea behind the Global Earth Observation System of Systems is not just to coordinate technology, but to bring different types of data together to attack societal problems. And that societal problem element is what's going to drive this process. This is not just about architecture and data formats and wires and wireless tools. This is about bringing together packets or portfolios of data so that decision makers can make some sense of it. There's a global piece, which is GEOS. There's also a national U.S. piece, which fits into the global piece. And this is the Integrated Earth Observation System, U.S. Integrated Earth Observation System. And this system is based on 9 societal benefits. And I'll just read them off. Improve weather forecasting, reduce loss of life and property from disasters, protect and monitor our ocean resource, understand, assess, predict, mitigate, and adapt to climate variability and change, support sustainable agriculture and forestry and combat land degradation, understand the effect of environmental factors on human health and well-being, develop the capacity to make ecological forecasts, protect and monitor water resources, and monitor and manage energy resources. These 9 societal benefits were identified as points of attack. We're going to try to address these needs by collecting Earth observations that are appropriate and make them fit together. We want to identify current and evolving requirements. In other words, we're not going to just go out and rewire the world. We're going to start by looking at what data is already being collected and try to bring that together. One thing that this will help us do is to prioritize investments. In other words, if you've got a societal need that you're trying to meet, and you've got several kinds of observations, then you can look at duplicates or you can look at gaps for meeting that societal need, and that helps guide your investments. And for policymakers, that's a very important process to go through. Utilize available technologies and sustain existing Earth observation systems. There's a difference historically between research and monitoring. And those of you in the room who are researchers, you tend to look at processes on a small scale over a limited period of time. Historically, monitoring has been broad scale over long periods of time. But as we attack things like climate change, now the research community and the monitoring community are starting to interact more and more. And so it's becoming more evident to everyone that we have to sustain certain kinds of observations. And that's going to be a priority. And so that makes Landsat look pretty good, doesn't it? This is the implementation strategy. I just want to point out again, I'm trying to drive this point home, that you don't start with the system. The mode we're in now is trying to perpetuate Landsat. And when you walk into OMB and you start talking about the system immediately, they tune out. They don't get it. They don't understand why this is so important, and you have to explain it to them over and over and over again. What we're trying to do is get out of that perpetuation mode and into a mode that begins with the societal benefits. It goes through some steps here that aren't shown of identifying indicators that tell you how well you're doing in that societal benefit. That tells you what kind of measurements you need to make. That tells you what kind of requirements there are. And then there's an architectural piece that everyone has to comply with. And that tells you ultimately what systems you need to launch. Now, you may think this is unnecessarily complicated because inherently you understand all this down here. You know why you're doing your work. You know what the benefits are. But those guys over at OMB, they don't know that. All they see is the maps and, you know, the landscape rendering and so on. They don't make that connection to the societal benefit automatically. You have to do that for them. And we haven't done that very well in the past. So with the new Earth observations philosophy, you have an opportunity in the Landsat community to fit beautifully into this implementation process. In other words, rather than trying to perpetuate a system, which is very difficult, you can go back and demonstrate within this paradigm that now has very high priority within the administration, is gaining momentum within Congress, makes a lot of sense to a lot of people. You come out with the same answer, but you do it in a much more rigorous and coherent way. And I think that's the path we're going to have to follow. Just to demonstrate that the administration really is committed to the Earth observation game, OMB has agreed to do some preliminary funding for prototypes. In other words, they're going to use existing systems, add a little money to that to make sure the systems are properly integrated, and see what the value-added products look like. OMB is going to be looking very closely at this set of near-term opportunities. And you notice that Global Land Observation System is one of those near-term opportunities, and it's focusing on agricultural issues. This is just going to be a prototype, but this will be an opportunity for Landsat to re-emerge in a different context, and I think a much more defensible and rigorous context. So just summarizing the Earth observation requirements, you have to address critical societal need. And I don't mean to demean the individual research projects that Landsat users use, but let me give you an illustration of how different the thinking is between scientists and policymakers. If you walk into a room and you see a Christmas tree, and the Christmas tree is covered with beautiful decorations, okay? You take a congressman by the hand, and you lead him over to the Christmas tree, and you start showing him or her these beautiful decorations that you've constructed. And there's a lot of them. The tree's covered with beautiful decorations. And you think, if you can convince this congressman that these beautiful decorations are very beautiful, that they will continue funding the tools you use to make those decorations. But you know what the congressman says? He says, why do I need a tree in my living room? You know, he's not concerned with the decorations. He's concerned with why there's a tree there. And as a community, to some extent, you have to get out of the mindset of thinking about the decorations and thinking about the tree and what the tree is and why it's there and how your work fits in with the tree and its function. That's not a very good metaphor, but you get the idea that there's a disconnect between the kind of thinking that policymakers use and scientists use. Sometimes it's just one of scale. It's important to try to understand. The only other thing I'll add from this slide is that any instruments that are funded in the future are going to have to be very competitive. The budget, federal budget, every year gets tighter and tighter. Money is more and more competed for, and there never was a free lunch, of course, but it's just going to be extremely competitive, and that's why it's very important for Landsat to have an advocate. So who's going to be the advocate for Landsat? It's a problem that we have to solve, because despite all the beautiful Christmas tree decorations that people are producing across the landscape, there's really no one there to explain why we need the tree. And that problem has to be solved, or Landsat's going to go away. And frankly, I don't think Landsat's going to go away. We may quit calling it Landsat. It may be called something else. But when we go through that integrated Earth observation system, I guarantee you that one of the conclusions in that process will be that we need Earth observations. We need mid-resolution Earth observations. I don't see any other conclusion we can come to. But it's not going to be because we're perpetuating the Landsat instrument. It's because we're going to re-justify it from scratch based on societal needs, and then someone has to take the leadership. And so those are problems that remain to be solved. I just want to congratulate all the Landsat users in the room and other remote sensing people for the wonderful work you do. I've looked at a lot of your products, and they're just incredible. I'm really pleased and impressed with the growing sophistication of the analytical algorithms that are being used, the application of remote sensing to solving real problems, and it's those societal benefits that we really have to focus on from now on. So let's put our heads together, and I'll do what I can, and you do what you can, and we'll write letters and chase congressmen down the street and try to make this thing work. So that's all I have, but thank you for your work.
We have 2 or 3 minutes for questions for Dr. Whitney.
I just want to thank you very, very much for your presentation, because I thought you really hit on, really the heart of the major issues. And while the subset of the larger industry that's in this room is primarily concerned with Landsat, I think that your conclusions in the end about ownership, advocacy, and leadership have giant implications that go way beyond Landsat, that affect many, many other similar problems in our industry that have to do with state and local government,
right,
geospatial data, disaster response, and so on and so forth. So it's important for the community that's not in this room, that's part of our membership, to really pay attention to this Landsat question, but when we come up with it, it's not just who owns Landsat, it's who owns geospatial data overall.
Right.
So we have to come up with an answer that's going to embody all those other pieces of technology.
Yeah. Appreciate that comment. And again, I would emphasize that the paradigm of the Earth observation system of systems, this integration of observation systems to address societal needs, that's a process that resonates extremely well with policymakers and budget people. And so I just encourage everyone to inform yourself about that process and join in a little bit. I know it'll get some of you out of your comfort zone, but I think it's a way to see some success in this area. Question?
Yes, sir. Is there any combination of scientific support from this community and others in combination with a collective effort to generate additional funding that could allow for the continuation of Landsat's robustness, particularly the retention of the thermal band, as well as the potential for direct broadcast, which would certainly assist in being responsive to both anthropogenic and biogenic disasters?
I'll just put it bluntly. Everyone has a favorite component, and the bottom line is going to be what we can afford. And when we go into a policy decision like this, it's setting a direction which then has to be negotiated and renegotiated continually through the budget process. And so we go through a design phase, and maybe you come up with Landsat 8 that has a thermal band on it, and the price tag is $500 million. And OMB comes back and says, no, you're not getting $500 million. You have to find a cheaper way to do it. Well, something's got to go at that point. So, you know, this next line of instruments has not been designed yet, or the next instrument has not been designed yet. I can't tell you whether it's going to have a thermal band on it or not. If we could have a thermal band on it, sure, we'd like to have one. But ultimately, it's going to come down to dollars and cents, I think. And so, frankly, you may not get your thermal band. Sorry. But maybe you will. I don't know. If we can also develop cheaper technologies, I didn't mention microsats and other kinds of things, but, you know, Landsat has the reputation of being the Cadillac of imaging instruments. It's very good. It's one of the things that allows us backward compatibility of the data and so on. But at some point, the community needs to ask yourself, if you don't have Landsat, then what kind of data is good enough? If you can't have the best, then what's good enough? And if it's what you can afford, it may not be anything like Landsat, but it may be good enough for identifying those or addressing those societal needs. Next question.
Yes, my name is Kevin Price, University of Kansas. One of the issues that I've seen that continually seems to be a problem for us is that there's very little funding to support work that would help our congressional representatives understand the value of our remote sensing work. And often the area that provides for that is an applied approach, and yet that is always just window dressing that is put in a program and often there one day and gone the next. And so it's very, very difficult for us to convince our constituents or our representatives that the remote sensing data are value to you if all they're seeing is the very esoteric work and not seeing any of the applied work and how it can be given, used for those who pay our taxes to solve problems and add value to the people who are actually paying for our salaries.
Yeah, well, that's a continual problem, and I would challenge you back to ask yourself if you're showing them the decorations or if you're addressing the issue of the tree. And the decorations are valuable and necessary and useful, but somebody also has to show these people the tree and why we need the tree. And what the policymakers are seeing now is just the decorations and not the tree. And so that's why we need strong advocacy and leadership, is to integrate and compile all this valuable work and show how, taken together, it makes a huge difference for our nation. And I've seen some of those. I mean, there have been workshops on land cover, land change, and those are very valuable activities, very valuable.
Gene, I'm Larry Handley with the USGS.
Hi, Larry.
I'm a resident of Louisiana. I'd like to know if our catastrophe has helped to convince the Hill, if it has helped at the White House and OMB as far as speeding up the process to be able to implement the Landsat and the Landsat data continuity mission.
I'm not sure what the connection is. I've seen, you know, I'm trying to be as honest as I can be here, folks. You know, I've seen the image, the Landsat images of before and after, but you know, that kind of imagery is not going to get Landsat funded. We need demonstrable proof that Landsat, used in an analytical way, will contribute to the future prevention of disasters, or improve recovery or something. Again, you know, when you see the before and after images published in books and magazines, it's more the Christmas tree decorations again. And if you can demonstrate that future hurricanes, the effect of future hurricanes can be reduced by the use of Landsat data, that's a much more important message than, but just the existence of this catastrophe, I don't think has affected the Landsat picture much. I'm sorry if I'm too abrupt. But.
Thank you for your questions, and thank you again, Dr. Whitney.